CTBK is more than just a full-service accounting firm. They are one team with an innovative approach to accounting and rise to each new challenge with collaborative problem-solving skills. CTBK goes above and beyond by lending helping hands in the Buffalo and Niagara community through volunteer work and donations, and is partnered up with Victory Sports for 2020 and 2021 to keep kids in the community active. The professionals at CTBK are determined to help individuals and businesses succeed. Whether a large corporation, a small business, or somewhere in between, call CTBK at 716-630-2400. Again, 716-630-2400, and see what CTBK's one-team approach can do for you.
Welcome to Tim Graham and Friends, brought to you by CTBK, CPAs and Business Consultants. I'm Tim Graham of The Athletic, here with Jonah Bronstein of Bronstein Sports Plus. And we are going to talk about the Buffalo Bills minus, because the roster has been carved. And some of the names were shocking yesterday when they were announced. It was a slow drip there for a little bit of just one player after another. Ian Rappaport, Adam Schefter, you know, fill in the blank as to whoever was first on many of these moves. I was fortunate to get a couple of the smaller ones. It was a pretty stunning day in Buffalo Bills history. I don't think that it quite matches the day that the Buffalo Bills cut Thurman Thomas, Andre Reed, and Bruce Smith all on the same day, three future Hall of Famers. But still, a lot of names and three former captains all gone within the span of 90 minutes, if you were following on social media, or one press release, if you were waiting for the Bills to make the announcement. Jonah, what were your impressions yesterday as this was happening? It's NHL trade deadline time. Most people were focused on that around Western New York. The Casey Mittelstadt trade was the headliner for much of the day. And then here comes Brandon Bean doing it all within the span of minutes, it seemed. The Bills roster looks totally different, just like that.
It was jarring, especially coming after the Mittelstadt trade, which shouldn't have been altogether surprising. And there was a lot of smoke that something like that could have been happening. But I think it caught a lot of Sabres fans and media by surprise, the timing of it, and maybe the expectation that Casey Mittelstadt was playing too well to be traded right now and could be traded later. Then the Bills' moves, which I think fit along the same category of each individual move made some sense, or each release and cap casualty, if you will, and a lot of the analysis coming into it listed the different options and the different players who might need to be sacrificed or released or restructured in order for the Bills to clear the cap room. But I don't think anybody expected all of those moves to be made in succession in one day, in the span of a few hours. And even if you did see it coming, it was just, used the word shocking. It was really surprising just to see how quickly the makeup of the Bills roster and culture, and how many, you know, you think about how many fans probably owned many of those jerseys, and just seeing that all happen right away. It probably isn't as historically significant as that day. And you wrote a really nice piece about that a few years ago when Andre Reed and Thurman Thomas and Bruce Smith were all released. But those guys were all really at the end of their career, and media was different then. There was no social media. It didn't come out the way it did in this trickle and stream of shocking news. And to me, it was, I can't really think of anything like that in Buffalo sports history, of how many different surprising things happen. I've seen it from a league level, watching NBA trade deadline or NHL trade deadline, and many, many surprising moves happen one by one. But I have not seen so much of that happen for one team, one Buffalo team, and following the other Buffalo team making a somewhat surprising move just hours before that.
Yeah, it's also not commensurate with the day the Buffalo Sabres lost Chris Drury and Daniel Briere. So I think on the list of jarring Buffalo sports days, it's probably down the list a little bit, but still, this was a reality check for a generation of sports fans. And this is life with a franchise quarterback. The salary cap is tight, even though it increased by a number that a lot of people didn't expect. The Bills were still really in a position where they had to make some difficult choices. But I think the fans also, because they're not used to this reality of Josh Allen and Stephon Diggs's contract, and even though Von Miller restructured his deal, still the big gamble that Brandon Bean made with adding Von Miller a couple years ago and in that exorbitant contract, there's this belief that the salary cap isn't real. And we even see some people on social media, even some members of the media, like to almost like it's a bit, talk about how the salary cap isn't real and you don't even need to worry about it. Well, yesterday was a smack in the head. It is very much real, and you're going to lose players you like, popular players. Just to give the rundown, and I know that people know these names, but just to give them all in one breath, they lose three former captains, center Mitch Morse, cornerback Tre'Davious White, safety Jordan Poyer. They also have previously lost Ryan Bates in a trade to the Chicago Bears. They cut wide receiver Deontay Hardy, running back Nyheim Hines, and defensive back Saran Neal. And just to round it out, they did make some other minor moves. Mitch Trubisky is back as Josh Allen's primary backup. I think that is an upgrade over Kyle Allen, to say the least, even though people are pretty down on Mitch Trubisky as an NFL talent anymore based on his poor performance with the Steelers the last couple of years. They bring back Taylor Rapp at safety. Punter Matt Hawk is back. David Edwards signs a new deal. And one report that was out there that I have not been able to get confirmed, so I'm just going to still say it's reported, Rasul Douglas, the cornerback who was such a great acquisition right before the trade deadline from the Green Bay Packers, Rasul Douglas reportedly has restructured his deal to make things a little bit easier for Brandon Bean moving forward, but I have not been able to get that one confirmed. That's been a loose thread out there for me. Anyway, that's a lot of names I just threw around. To me, and you can pick where we go with this, but the two big takeaways for me, well, I guess three things. And from a macro sense, and then two subsets. From a macro sense, it was a bewildering day for a journalist to cover. You know, as a fan, you can absorb it and try to process things as you're getting flooded with all these names and popular players. Like you say, guys who sold a lot of jerseys among the fan base are no longer on the team. But we're constantly trying to get these confirmed. The report comes out from a Schefter or a Field Yates or a Ian Rappaport, and we need to get these confirmed as quickly as we can. So The Athletic, you know, we don't want to rely on somebody else's report. So that's that. I'm doing write-ups. I'm doing a take on what we thought was just going to be a Jordan Poyer story turned into a roster massacre story. My head was spinning, trying to just keep up. But I think that you look at all of these and they all make sense. The one that really stood out to me was Mitch Morse. He was the biggest eyebrow raiser. However, it does make sense. He was making a lot of money. I know he's incredibly important to the offensive line, and you're talking about a unit that when the season was over, the strength heading into the offseason was this entire offensive line is coming back. You didn't have to worry about the offensive line at all. And So whatever else Brandon Bean needed to do, he could set aside this offensive line that is fully intact, all incumbent. But he is going to be 32 next month. He does have a concussion history. Now they're talking about moving Connor McGovern from guard to center. David Edwards then filling in at that left guard position, unless they want to move Osiris Torrance over to the other side, or however they might want to do whatever they might want to do with their offensive line. So now you have an offensive line that went from being cement to being a bit in flux, and you now have Connor McGovern playing a new position, et cetera, et cetera. And then the other part for me was just the total overhaul of the defensive backfield. They've lost their defensive backfield coach, John Butler. He wanted that defensive coordinator job that Sean McDermott gave to Bobby Babich. And out of principle, John Butler has left so that way he can go pursue being a defensive coordinator somewhere else. Bobby Babich is young, and if he is successful in Buffalo, that's going to be a hindrance for John Butler. So for career purposes, he decided he had to leave. So the Bills have different coaches back there. And now they have what? They have Taylor Rapp. They have, let me just pull it up. This is what the Bills have under contract in the defensive backfield. Christian Benford and Rasul Douglas at cornerback. Kair Elam is a huge question mark still entering his third season. Taron Johnson at nickel, of course, one of the best in the league there. Taylor Rapp, who I was not all that impressed with last year. I had heard so many good things about him, and his ratings on the analytics were really good. And I know that the Bills were high on him to come in and replace a Micah Hyde or a Jordan Poyer eventually. And with the exception of that big interception in Miami in which he got hurt late in the season, I don't know. They're just, and maybe we're spoiled because we're just so used to seeing Poyer and Hyde back there that anybody just was going to be a disappointment. But anyways, Taylor Rapp and then DeMar Hamlin, also the only two safeties on the roster, Rapp and Hamlin. This is a defensive backfield that is going to be overhauled. As Sean McDermott, that's kind of like his pride and joy is his defensive backfield, the former defensive back at William & Mary. He's been able to identify guys, particularly at the safety position, to come in. The Bills are going to have to work some magic, I think, to put a unit together and hope that they find chemistry right away, because those guys, they damn near had ESP back there. They'd played together so long. I'm talking about Poyer and Hyde. But Tre'Davious White.
While it's not the secondary that the Bills started the year with, and it's not the ideal secondary if you're just picking names and putting accomplishments out there, but it is at all of those spots, players that started games for the Bills last year, played significant amounts, and I don't know if they had that exact combination out there starting in the same game, but very well could have because of the Tre'Davious White injuries and Micah Hyde getting hurt towards the end of the year. These were guys that played a lot and played a lot together. It does feel, other than Rasul Douglas, it does feel a little bit like the second string secondary, but the Bills had some really good stretches of play, especially in their pass defense, without a lot of the big names in the lineup last year. And I think if you want to look at it from the glass half full standpoint, they're not bringing in totally unproven players to replace these excellent players that they got rid of. They're replacing them with guys who've been on the roster that know the defense and have had.
Yeah, I'll be honest. I don't mind the cornerback duo, if it sticks, of Christian Benford and Rasul Douglas, and Taron Johnson, of course, is in that nickel spot. So you don't have to worry about that. I don't mind that, really. I guess it really comes down to the safeties and how important they are in Sean McDermott's defense and making sure everybody's in the right place, the communication aspect of it. Now, of course, Taylor Rapp has a year under his belt of having been around the system and and what McDermott wants and how Poyer and Hyde handled things. And then whoever the other safety is going to be. A lot of safeties on the market. Teams are just dumping safeties left and right. Guys who've been to Pro Bowls and have been considered for all pro. I mean, they're just dudes with deep experience all over the place. You know, who knows if that waters down the market, brings down some prices, and the Bills are able to get an experienced safety back there. That look, when they identified Hyde, I'm saying they, you know, Brandon Bean wasn't even the general manager yet when the Bills signed Micah Hyde and Jordan Poyer. They weren't superstars. Jordan Poyer was having trouble starting for the Cleveland Browns. He was a late round draft pick of the Eagles, got picked up off waivers in his rookie season by the Browns, was a special teamer, had injury issues. And Sean McDermott, from the brief exposure that he had to Poyer with the Philadelphia Eagles, remembered him as a guy that he thought could do the job. And clearly he did. He broke out immediately in 2017. And so, look, that's not to say that Sean McDermott can just go ahead and do that whenever he wants, but he does have a track record of identifying good safeties. And they're likely banking on the fact that they think they can do that again.
Yeah. And to react to your Morris point real quick, I think it surprised me the most, because it came after the Ryan Bates trade, because Ryan Bates seemed to be the guy who was signed last year as the potential Mitch Morse replacement and had been his backup in some ways. And had also started at guard earlier in his career. And when the Bills traded him to Chicago, I thought that meant that they were keeping Mitch Morse, maybe finding a way to extend his deal and lower his cap number, even though 32 is on the wrong side of 30. You could probably do a 3-year deal with him and still get NFL seasons out of that. And it was surprising that the Bills got rid of both of their centers. And Connor McGovern, I'm not questioning whether he can play center, but we didn't really know that, or that seemed to be a little bit of an unexpected move that the Bills are making, and potentially a risky move if it doesn't work out. And Mitch Morse just being, you know, other than Josh Allen, the kind of the captain of the offense and the spokesman of the offense, and it seemed like he was a very important part of the team's culture, as some of these other players were. But to me, that was the most surprising move.
He was the wise old man in the locker room. I mean, he was the go-to guy after every game. He was philosophical. He put things in perspective. He put things in the proper context when things were bad. But he also didn't, he also was the type of guy who, what's the word I'm looking for? Like, He was blunt enough about it. I mean, he faced the reality. He didn't dodge it. He wasn't, you know, like Von Miller, everything is always going to be great the very next practice or the very next game. And I guarantee this, and you know, everything's great, great, great. Well, Mitch Morse he acknowledged when things were dicey, and he's going to be missed, clearly, from a leadership standpoint. A lot of these guys, huge leaders.
And Mitch Morse was asked on locker cleanout day about this potential, that he was going into the last year of his contract with a bigger cap number and the Bills had some cap constraints. And he kind of chuckled. And I believe he said, you know, I wasn't expecting that question. And the impression I got was that he hadn't really thought about the possibility that he could be released because of his contract. Whereas, Micah Hyde's contract was up, but Jordan Poyer, a lot of these players seem to understand the position they were in with their contracts and the position the Bills were in. And Mitch Morse, I believe, coming out of locker cleanout day, seemed pretty certain that he was going to be back on the Bills roster. And not knowing this at all, not reporting this, I believe, you know, he probably thought that if he wasn't back on the same contract, he'd be back on a new redone contract. And the Bills decided to go a different route at that position.
That's how much money they needed to cut from the roster. It was just too much, and they had to make big decisions. They couldn't just tinker through it. They couldn't just tweak and nibble and get rid of this guy and ask for this contract restructure. You know, it was they had to make tough decisions. And I think too, that the injury history plays a big part because imagine, granted, Mitch Morse is an important player. We just went through the whole thing. He was a Pro Bowler just 2 years ago, grades out very well at center, captain the whole thing. But he does have the concussion history. And if you're going to bank on him and he misses three or four games, that's the type of thing that can sink you. And I think that the Bills would love to move on from Von Miller. They just couldn't. You know, there's just too much guaranteed money. And I think that, you know, Von Miller is said to yearn to be an NFL executive someday. So perhaps Brandon Bean had a executive heart-to-heart with Von and maybe explained to him that this is what you as a general manager would hope your star players would do for you when you're in this situation, would be to restructure a deal so that way we can make other moves and be that much more flexible. And perhaps was able to speak to Von Miller in those terms, and Von Miller, the future NFL executive that he hopes to be, was able to get to a place mentally where he was willing to make that sacrifice. I do want to say, and I guess this was one of the overarching points I was going to make very early in this podcast, was, you know, people are busted up about all these moves. And like you said, you use the word jarring. I think that when you get past the sentimentality of it, the fact that the recency bias, none of these moves is really wrenching. And we just went through all of them. You know, Tre'Davious White, but Brandon Bean made it a point to say that they have no idea when he's going to be back, not only in uniform and able to contribute at all, but back to full speed from his Achilles injury. And he even mentioned next year, like, they can't just keep Tre'Davious White around because he's popular and he danced on the field. And 5 years ago, he was a candidate for Defensive Player of the Year. And, you know, he makes cool videos and he's funny with the Goalie Academy. And, you know, okay, that's fine. But this is a team with Super Bowl aspirations and they need money to bank on players who they know are going to be on the field, not guys who, you know, that have meant a lot to the team and you don't know if they're going to be around. Maybe they will be. Just having guys in the locker room or on the sideline to give everybody attaboys while they're recovering from injuries or can't get on the field doesn't go that far when you're counting every penny.
Yeah, and they can't pay two cornerbacks big money with the situation that they're in, and also having Benford and Kyrie Elam on rookie deals, and really got to get Elam on the field, I think, a bit more in year three than they've been able to do in the first 2 years. As soon as they made the trade for Rasul Douglas and he established himself as an excellent player, and in some ways with his ball skills, maybe more effective than Tre'Davious White had been, even in some of his very best years, or when Tre'Davious White wasn't playing at his very best, was not as impactful as Rasul Douglas proved to be in the second half of the season. Once Rasul Douglas kind of earned his spot on the roster going forward, I think that was the writing on the wall for Tre'Davious White. But one of my takeaways from yesterday, and it didn't happen right away because who they cut and the jarring aspect of it was the big takeaway right away. But then as they kept making more and more moves and redoing the Von Miller deal, which I thought was a great piece of cap gymnastics by Brandon Bean because they get the cap room, but Von Miller, if he returns to being Von Miller and has a double-digit sack season, can get most of that money back, but it'll show up on the 2025 cap instead of this season. But seeing all the moves they made to get under the cap, making maybe one or two more moves than they needed to do to get under the cap, still having the ability to restructure Josh Allen's giant contract and maybe do something with Deion Dawkins, Dawson Knox, or a couple other players, they can still get more cap room if they need it. That tells me that I think the Bills want to go spend some money, that whether it's re-signing A.J. Epenesa, re-signing Daquan Jones, signing other players in free agency, that the Bills didn't want to be in a situation, it's kind of what we talked about last year, that Brandon Bean would be able to maneuver to get cap compliant and keep the roster together, but that they wouldn't have much money to spend. Now he's put them in a position. They're not there yet. There's more moves that need to be made to do that, but now they're in a position to spend money if they identify players that they want to spend it on and add in places where they think they're weak, whether it's defensive tackle, safety, wide receiver. They won't have their hands tied behind their back when it comes to free agency opening next week and adding more players to the roster.
I also want to make a point about Jordan Poyer. Yes, a Warrior playing with a still healing punctured lung, to where the Bills had to get him a sprint van and drive him from Buffalo to Kansas City. So that way the Bills would have him in Arrowhead Stadium in a game that he played great. The Bills won because he couldn't fly with his, with the air pressure and his lung injury and the dislocated this and the sprained that. And I mean, the guy just played through so much. But as the Bills showed heading into last season, they were not willing to extend him or give him too much. You know, you recall Jordan Poyer firing his agent, hiring Drew Rosenhaus, and you thought, uh-oh, here we go. We're going to go to the mats over a contract. But here he is. He's going to be 33 next month. And, Brandon Bean, I think, was right. He played 16 games. He had no interceptions for the first time since he was a Brown. So going back seven, for the first time in 8 years, he had zero interceptions. He had only four passes defensed. He had a forced fumble, but he had one sack. It just was not that great of a season for Jordan Poyer, even though the Bills' defense played well. They were one of the best defenses in the NFL, and he was a part of it. But you could just tell, a step has been lost. He has eroded just because that's what human beings do, especially human beings who play the game like he does. Jordan Poyer, again, a Warrior, means a lot to the turnaround of 17 years without the playoffs into a perennial Super Bowl contender, a legitimate Super Bowl contender. He and Micah Hyde and Tre'Davious White and Mitch Morse played huge roles in making that happen. But with that success comes difficult decisions. Anything else Bills related before I ask you about the Casey Mittelstadt trade?
No, I think I'd make a quick mention when you mentioned it with Jordan Poyer. Bills lost and are in the process of losing a few players that were very involved in the community. Older veteran players tend to maybe do that a bit more than younger players. And there'll be different players who step up, and the Bills Community Relations Department will probably work to fill that void. But there'll be a loss that goes beyond the football field of losing this many key players and this many key personalities. Rachel Bush will still be out there, but we won't have as much Buffalo context and following her Twitter and all the different things. So there's,
is that bad?
Well, to some it's maybe good and to some it's bad, but and not all of this is a good and bad loss, but there will be a loss. A lot of things that were familiar, a lot of things that you came to understand about the Bills and the culture and Bills Mafia and things like
That's
that true. Are going to change and going to be different. And as media people, there's going to be a lot of new personalities to get to know, a lot of players that were go-to guys or that people had established relationships with and kind of knew when to talk to them. Micah Hyde was a player who was very good to talk to. And also in certain situations, you kind of knew he was the guy to go to after the story came out about Sean McDermott's 9/11 comments. He was the only player kind of willing to talk on that first practice. And he was the key player to talk to. There'll be less players who were around and actually almost no players who were around in Sean McDermott's first year left on this team. And so some of that historical connection and institutional knowledge and being able to tie the current Bills into the team that ended the drought and Sean McDermott's first year, that there's a loss there. And, it'll be different covering this team and different rooting for this team and watching this team until we get to know and accept and understand the new roster going forward.
It's a great point. I hadn't even thought of that, even when we were talking about Mitch Morrison as the philosopher that he is. After a Bills game, there were a handful of people that were at the podium every game. Josh Allen, of course, the quarterback is always pretty much any NFL team. That's the way it is. And the head coach. But beyond that, it was Mitch Morse was going to be up there. Jordan Poyer and Micah Hyde were going to be up there. So that's three. And I don't know. That's five people. Is there somebody else who's always up there? Oh, Deion Dawkins, I think. But he,
Dawson Knox talks a lot.
Yeah. Dawson Knox is another one. He's another go-to guy. After the game. But yeah, that's three important voices that that's not just for us. That means those are the voices the fans heard more than anybody else's in explaining what happened in the game or what is important about the upcoming opponent or this trend, whether it be positive or negative, what's going on, social issues. Yeah, you're right. It is a loss with many of these guys.
And that goes the other way a little bit because these players had, even though there were sometimes some dust-ups, these players knew the media and knew what kind of questions they were going to get asked and how to respond, and they had some comfort level with the beat reporters that are there every day. New players come in, and they don't have that right away, so they might be a little less open and a little less media friendly until they get that comfort level. So there's going to be something lost, and that's not a woe is the media take, but it's going to be an interesting offseason, kind of getting to know who the new go-to guys are and establishing those relationships on both sides.
Casey Mittelstadt was a great guy in the room when it came to the media. What I was impressed by with Casey Mittelstadt when I was covering the Sabres again back in December was that he stuck around after losses more than he stuck around after wins in the dressing room when the media was allowed in there. And I was like that. I mean, I don't know. It just said something to me about the guy. What? I don't know. But the fact that he would be in there longer after a loss, maybe he wanted to soak it in a little bit. Maybe he wanted to feel it. I don't know. But anyway, Casey Mittelstadt traded to the Colorado Avalanche for defensemen. Bowen Byram. Byram is 2.5 years younger than Casey Mittelstadt. Mittelstadt 25, and Byram doesn't turn 23 until June. You know, Jonah, it looks like a decent hockey trade, you know, one player for one player. You can never have too many talented defensemen. But do the Sabres need to get younger? I mean, I kind of get it. You know, Mittelstadt was the most tradable asset given his contract. But at what point do you groom or do you have your guys around for the 25 to 30 aspect of their careers as opposed? I mean, this seems to me kicking the can down the road more of the Sabres saying, well, we're not ready to compete yet. We're not ready to maximize a Casey Mittelstadt. Let's maybe even if it's a little bit, we're going to dial it back. We're dialing it back because we need to get more people ready to go in a year or two from now.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. The Sabres should not be getting younger. You know, now and in the offseason, they're transitioning the roster from this year to next year. And I think they need to be very careful to not let that happen because they're probably going to trade Eric Johnson this week, possibly could trade Kyle Okposo as well.
For the record, just so people know, we're recording this before the game Thursday night against the Nashville Predators. So things could happen tonight or tomorrow or on Friday if you're listening to this on Friday. So anyways, I'm sorry, Jonah, but you're Eric Johnson, Kyle Okposo, two veterans who the Sabres will probably try to put on teams to give them a chance to have a postseason push.
Zemgus Girgensons perhaps as well. And all three of those players, I would think, are not going to be back next year, even if they're not traded here at the deadline and could possibly be replaced by much younger players in Rochester. I think Kevin Adams needs to be mindful of that and try to sign some veterans and not make this an even younger team next year, similar to how we did last year with, you know, the team getting younger, even with almost all of the players themselves getting a year older. However, Casey Mittelstadt wasn't an old player, even though he had been on the team a long time. So I don't know if this particular trade changes that very much.
No, what I'm saying, though, I mean, just to make what, no, he's not an old player, but isn't this the type of player that you want to get into the mid to later age of your career? You need older, you know, guys that have been in your system that you groomed to get to this point. And granted, you know, calling him the Sabres leading scorer, every time I kept hearing that yesterday, Sabres leading scorer, Casey Mittelstadt, I roll my eyes, because if you go to NHL.com and click the stats button, you got to scroll for a while before you find Casey Mittelstadt's name on the leaderboard. But still, he's a player who has been playing well. And these are the types of players that you still need. So I don't know. To me, it just, again, it was a player for player trade. It seemed pretty even. It just seemed, I don't know, the getting younger aspect of it just stuck with me.
Yeah, well, and Casey Mittelstadt is the team's leading scorer and also the team leader in plus minus. He's been probably the team's best forward this year, maybe not the best player, but he's been one of the most important players. He's played on the top line at times. He's kind of driven his own line as a third line center. He's played up and down the lineup. He's had a great year. He kind of had a career year last year, but he's had another career year, and he's developed well in the Sabres, and he was a top 10 draft choice. And I think if the general manager that drafted him was still on the team, you would think he's a guy that they would want to keep and re-sign and continue to build around. But this always made sense. I think a year ago, when there were some rumors about what the Sabres would do at the trade deadline, it was always trading Casey Mittelstadt for a top four defenseman. And maybe they weren't able to pull that deal off a year ago. And even coming into this season, it still seemed like, if you look at the Sabres roster, they had center depth, and even the Sabres payroll, they had paid Tage Thompson and Dylan Cousin more than $7 million a year. Casey Mittelstadt's contract was up, and it might take about $7 million a year, $6 million a year to re-sign him, and that the Sabres couldn't afford to do that with another player, that it wasn't the right way to construct this roster, but that they probably did need another top four defenseman, and they got one that's making a similar contract figure to Casey Mittelstadt. It always made the most sense as a hockey trade to trade one of the middle six centers for a top four defenseman. It was just, to me, a little alarming, the timing of it, because it really did seem like Casey Mittelstadt was such an important part of this year's team that even though it looks like they're not going to make the playoffs, they're not quite out of it yet, there's the opportunity to maybe trade Casey Mittelstadt in the offseason as he's a restricted free agent, and that it seemed like that was the way it was going to go, that he would finish out the season and potentially get traded at a later date. Or, you know, the Sabres have the ability to get that top four defenseman with picks and prospects and maybe not trade Casey Mittelstadt. But not renegotiating his contract, not talking to him about a contract extension, it seems like Kevin Adams decided long ago that Casey Mittelstadt wouldn't be part of this team's future, and that eventually they needed another top-level defenseman in that spot, and that's kind of a way to balance this roster and move forward. And getting one that was a number four overall pick that's even younger than Casey Mittelstadt, even though you don't want the whole team to get younger, just as far as assets go, having that position at a younger age than the third center that you traded is kind of a win.
Yeah, I'm the youth aspect of any hockey team, not just the Buffalo Sabres, is been a little mystifying in recent years, in that, and John Tortorella was talking about it just a couple of weeks ago about young players today. And I don't think it was old man shaking his fist at a cloud type stuff. It is just the way that hockey culture has changed, in that the hierarchy of the veteran leader, the code, you know, all the different things about minding your place and sit there and shut up and learn how the game is played and learn from your elders and all the different things that go into, you know, the hockey evolution of a player, the development of a player in terms of the intangibles. One second. excuse me. And Tortorella was saying, we just don't have that anymore. Players come into the league with more leverage and more power than they've ever had. And, you know, they've been coached since, you know, and had their specialists and their trainers and all these different things for years. They don't necessarily listen to coaches, like, because they have so many people on their own teams, you know, their own, I don't mean entourages, like, you know, buddies that just leech onto them. I'm talking about they have their own little organizations, the best players when they enter the league. And it just, the idea of the youth movement or having a youthful team, there just seems to be more and also, well, let me finish that thought, more variables than ever in the National Hockey League when it comes to youth development. And it's also the sport in which the players enter the league at the youngest age. Yes, baseball players also get drafted out of high school, but they also then just say no, go to college, get drafted again. You can get drafted 4 or 5 times in baseball. Whereas in hockey, you're drafted, you're evaluated at a young age. You know, that's pretty much, you know, where you are at 19 is how the NHL figures you're going to be. And everything's based off of that. So variables out the wazoo with young hockey players since the dawn of time. But as labor has gotten more powerful within this collective bargaining agreement, as the game has changed, it just seems to me is that it's volatile. The youth aspect in hockey is volatile in terms of providing no guarantees for success, because it's just too unknown and it's a little untethered. And it doesn't have the guidance that it used to have, or at least the direction or the template that it used to have. And granted, you know, Don Granato is known as a great development coach, but he's also really inexperienced at the NHL level. He's not had any success at the NHL level. His entire coaching staff, well, at least with the exception of his goaltending coach, who apparently couldn't identify Ukko-Pekka Luukkonen as a potential game changer, and forcing Devin Levi to be the opening day starter and workhorse to begin the season. Aside from him, the Sabres coaching staff has zero NHL playoff coaching experience. I don't know. I mean, to me, just getting younger, it's a plan, it's a strategy, but I don't know. Well, I think it works in different sports way more. I mean, hockey just doesn't seem to be, the fruit doesn't seem to be bearing out with youth movements in the National Hockey League, in today's National Hockey League.
Yes. I'm glad you brought up playoff experience, however, because Bowen Byram, as young as he is, has played 27 NHL playoff games, and he was a plus 15 playing 19 minutes a night when Colorado won the cup 2 years ago. And he's at his age, he doesn't fit the profile of that veteran player that's won a cup that can come in and teach the team, but he's done it himself. If the Sabres do make it to the playoffs next season or in the future, he's not going to be a wide-eyed young player that's never been in that moment before. And some of that might be able to rub off.
True.
And just having that, being around other teams and players that played in the NHL playoffs and the Stanley Cup playoffs and won, I think that he will bring a little bit of residual veteran experience that doesn't match up with his name and age and number of games played, but maybe in his mind, he's a little bit more of a veteran player than you see, you know, on paper.
Oh, I agree with that. I agree. However, I wish that the Sabres had a couple of those guys who were 25 or 26, not 22 coming in, because who's going to listen to Bo Byram? I mean, and that's not to say that he doesn't have a big voice and, you know, whatever, but he's 22. And there's other young guys in there, and I guess maybe that's what you need. Maybe you just need another. But is Bo Byram going to walk into the Sabres dressing room and say, you know, I don't like the way this has been. This is the way it's got to be done, guys. Well, that's what Chris Drury did, actually, when he came from Colorado and made sure that the Sabres put the Stanley Cup photo on the locker room wall, because he said, this is what we're playing for, and we should see it every day. It has no has no bearing as to whether or not this organization has ever won a Stanley Cup. We have a picture of the Stanley Cup on this wall. When we put our sticks in the rack on our way off the ice and to our locker stalls every day, we see this Stanley Cup every day. So yeah, Chris Drury was wired a little bit different. I don't know. Maybe Bo Byram's that guy, but at 22 to be able to come in and I'm not going to say flex it, but I mean, I don't know. It doesn't hurt. It doesn't hurt. And I'm being cynical regarding this. I'm admittedly cynical regarding it. You need somebody in between Bo Byram and Eric Johnson. You know, can you give me somebody with some playoff experience who is serviceable on a nightly basis and can tell the young guys this is how you do it, as opposed to a guy who, he just started to be able to have a beer in the United States not that long ago.
Yeah, they still have a need to trade for Sidney Crosby, which is one of these things kind of like SummerSlam at the stadium that I just want to speak into existence, and more Blue Jays games in Buffalo. I still think that's exactly what the Sabres need. And as crazy as it sounds, they have the assets to maybe pull that off if he's ever on the trading block. And just 1 or 2 years of a super captain, super experienced player like that might be quite what the Sabres need. But, you know, that's probably unrealistic to think they could pull that off. But this trade and not re-signing Casey Mittelstadt to a bigger number still does give the Sabres cap room to make another big move in the offseason and continue to add to the roster while getting that top four defenseman that they've needed a long time. And eventually they'll have to pay Bo Byram, but for the next 2 years, they're not paying him a lot of money.
You know, back in December when I wrote that story for The Athletic after the Sabres got totally annihilated by the Columbus Blue Jackets, and I walked into the locker room and nobody from the defensive side of the defensive side was even at their locker stalls when the media was let in. And I made a reference to, as you may recall, that back in the day, and not that long ago, but every player would be at his locker stall for at least a couple of minutes to be accountable. If you want to talk to me, I am here. And if the reporters then went to one or two other players, they would say, okay, well, at least I was here and I was available, as opposed to scurrying out. And Kyle Okposo was the one who stood there and answered all the questions as the captain. And that's what captains do on a daily basis. But after a game like that, those are special occurrences in which your team should probably help the captain out and take a bite of the shit sandwich. You know, we're all going to take a bite of this turd burger. And so a couple of days later, I went up to Kyle and I said, why'd you stand there by yourself and do that? And he was like, shouldn't somebody else have been there to help? And he said, guys just don't do that anymore. Like, that's just doesn't happen. And he wasn't saying it as a knock. He was just saying, the game has changed. Now here's an active NHL player. He's just saying, yeah, that's the way it was. That's the way it was when I first got into the league, but we just don't do that anymore. Or guys just don't do that anymore. Guys don't think that way. And that's what John Tortorella was referencing when he was talking about how tricky it is with young players these days. And that, to me, was suggestive of what the Sabres are up against, even though they have a ton of talent. And it seems like an annual occurrence that either The Athletic or the Hockey News or some publication is going to rank the Sabres prospect pool number one in the NHL for however many years running. And they still can't get into the postseason because youth provides no guarantees, no matter how talented it is. And maybe this is a separate conversation about the tank and what a folly that was to think that one player was going to change your fortunes. All these young, talented players aren't getting it done. And it comes off to me repeatedly as risky. And to see Casey Mittelstadt get traded for a player, a talented player with great upside, but still 2.5 years younger, it just seems to me that they just keep dialing it back. And maybe it works, but I'm wary of it.
And Mittelstadt had some of that grain to him. And as you mentioned earlier on, he's a player that maybe would be standing there at his locker after a loss, even if nobody wanted to talk to him, but there to be seen and to be available just in case and have that level of accountability. And even if the Sabres hockey-wise in the long run don't miss Casey Mittelstadt, or they're able to replace Casey Mittelstadt with some of these exciting young prospects that they have, and they're better off with the defenseman in that salary slot, he'll be missed in the locker room by, I think, the teammates and the coaching staff and the media and his personality. And he's a player that's been in Buffalo for a good long while. He won a World Junior Championship after the Sabres had drafted him in Buffalo. I think a lot of fans got to know him early on in his career and became fans of his, and he was a popular player. So as we talked about with some of the Bills, he'll be missed in ways that are off the ice and don't really reflect on the games you're watching on television and things like that, but will be missed in the culture and the fabric of the Sabres somewhat.
And by account of all the players who know him or have played with him, Bo Byram is a great addition. I mean, they're excited to have him. I was encouraged by that, to hear the teammates be excited as opposed to depressed after a trade, you know, because sometimes, you know, this is the type of trade in which, you know, the Sabres know what's up. They see the writing on the wall. They know they're probably not making the playoffs this year. And so to see them excited despite losing Casey Mittelstadt, I thought was pretty encouraging. Jonah, Damon basketball, they won their first round game in the East Coast Conference tournament. What do they look like in terms of a Division II tournament team? Do they have to win the conference to get in, or what's their situation?
Well, they're 23-7, ranked number 6 in the East region, and those rankings are a little different than, you know, like the AP poll. This is it's almost like the selection committee. They are ranked 6th in a bracket where 8 teams will be selected to the NCAA tournament. However, there are automatic bids. If enough teams that aren't in that top 8 do win their conferences in the East region, they could be knocked out of position for an at-large bid. That's what happened to them a year ago when they were ranked 7th or 8th, and they kind of got knocked down the peg by some bid stealers. So they go to this East Coast Conference Championship Tournament. It's being hosted by the number 1 seed, St. Thomas Aquinas. This is the 10th time in 10 seasons under Coach Mike McDonald since they went to Division II that Damon has made it to the last 4 teams in the conference, but they've never won the conference tournament. They've won regular season championships, but have almost always lost to this St. Thomas Aquinas team. Sometimes have lost to other teams in the semifinals. So, you know, this would be a significant moment if they're able to win these 2 games and get to the NCAA tournament with an automatic bid. But if they win this semifinal against Staten Island, which is a team they've struggled against this season, but if they can win that game on a neutral floor, get to that final against St. Thomas Aquinas, which will then be on a non-neutral floor, they're in a pretty good position, I think, to get into the Division II tournament, even without a win in the final, if that's how it plays out.
Jonah, I know we've been at it for almost an hour now, and I'm starting to lose my voice, but let's take a, and we're going to be talking about college basketball for the next few weeks. Can you give us a quick spin around the Big Four and how those teams are looking? I mean, you can leave out the UB men or whatever, but how those teams are looking heading into their conference tournaments.
Well, the UB men's season will end tomorrow night. They're not going to make it to the MAC tournament. If they lose this final home game, they'll set the school record for losses. So there's something on the line in that last game, but then they won't be playing in the conference tournament. Bonaventure, again, as I've said all year, I got to look up exactly where they are, but I think they're about 6th in the A-10 standings, but they're playing well. They've got some good wins. I still think they're the most likely team to potentially win their tournament and make it to the NCAA tournament. They're not a team that's going to get an at-large bid and probably won't be in the Atlantic or the NIT tournament either way. And then in the MAC, Niagara's
Canisius is warming up, though, huh?
Canisius is warming up. They do have the injuries and some depth. I was out at practice yesterday, and Reggie was asking me if I was medically clear that they might need me to play in Atlantic City at the tournament. And Canisius, I mean, the writing is on the wall that this is probably Reggie Witherspoon's last year at Canisius, if not definitely.
Do you get the sense talking to him that he feels, do you sense him like soaking things in, or can you pick up clues?
Can pick up clues more off the record in the periphery with people that know him. It isn't something that he's really acknowledged in interviews and seems to want to talk about. I think he's of the mind that they could still win this tournament. And that would be very interesting, because I do think if Canisius were to win the MAC tournament for the first time since 1996 and go to the NCAA tournament, I think they'd have to consider maybe bringing Reggie Witherspoon back on a short-term contract, because how do you fire a guy after that kind of glorious moment? But they're going to be the ninth seed in the MAC tournament. That means that if they do win their first game, they're going to be playing the number one seed in the first round. I guess if you win that game, then anything can happen. But the likelihood, especially with only seven scholarship players healthy and two walk-ons that might have to play a little bit at this tournament, the likelihood of them winning four games in 5 nights or whatever that is with that short roster seems very unlikely. And I think short of winning the MAC tournament, I think that's what it would take. Probably to save Reggie Witherspoon's job at Canisius at this point. So this is the end of an era with Canisius, but interesting to watch kind of how well they play and how deep they can get into this tournament and how that plays out. They also have two regular season games left to play before we get to that tournament. And Niagara is a little bit higher in the conference standings. They've lost, I believe, their last two games. They're not playing quite as well as they were a week or so ago, 2 weeks ago, but has a full roster and seems to have maybe, I think, a better chance of making a surprise run for the tournament. They're down there in sixth in the conference standings right now. I don't think either one of these teams are going to win the MAC, but Niagara seems to have a slightly better chance. On the women's side, the Niagara women are going to be the number two seed, but the number one seed is Fairfield, and they're ranked in the top 25. And Niagara had won, I think, 10 in a row and then lost by 20-plus points at Fairfield. So it's going to be very difficult for them to win that tournament, but seem to have an excellent job of maybe getting to the final and maybe getting back to the women's NIT as they did last year. UB women are going to be top four. Canisius, I think, is fourth in their league. So those are the women's teams have some potential to make a run. Bonn is already out. The Atlantic women's tournament has already started and they've already lost. And that's the runaround.
All right. Well, thanks, Jonah.
And Damon, the Damon women are the number one seed and they have a very good chance of winning their tournament and going back to the Division II NCAA tournament for, I believe, the fourth year in a row.
How about N-Trip while we're at it?
N-Triple-C, the men's season is over. They didn't win their region, but the N-Triple-C women did win their region six in a row under Coach Nate Butel. And before he got there 8 or 9 years ago, they had never won their regional title before. But they have to win another district playoff game on Saturday to get to the Division II Junior College National Tournament.
Beautiful.
Villa Maria and Bryan and Stratton, they're playing in the USCA National Tournament, which is, I like to say, call that like Division Five. Is a bit of a joke, but it is kind of exciting for the players and the coaches on that team that they were able to win their conferences and get to that tournament. And next year, that USCAA tournament will be hosted in Buffalo at Erie Community College. So if you're really interested in small college basketball, that's something to keep an eye on this March.
Jonah, thanks for this. You seem to be getting stronger too.
Yeah, if you're just listening to this on audio, people probably think I'm healthier than you are.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, do the quiz and find out which one had a heart attack. I think that I get most votes. Jonah, thanks again. Thanks to everybody out there for listening. Please subscribe, give us a like, rate us, comment. Hey, I'll speak on Jonah's behalf. Thanks to all the people who dropped the line in the comments under the YouTube video for Jonah last week.
Yeah, and a lot of personal messages that I received from listeners and friends of the show, guests we've had on, and that was heartwarming and heart healing and heart healthy to hear so many people and so many listeners. Just to know we have that many listeners paying attention and feeling like they can reach out to us, that was, nice to see, nice to hear.
And thanks to everybody. Thanks to Jonah. Thanks to
CTBK.
Yeah, I was going to try to come up with something clever and I couldn't do it. I'm on too much NyQuil.
Thanks to Brandon Bean for doing all that work yesterday and giving us something to talk about.
I didn't like it when it was happening, but if it's going to clear our weekend out, I guess I got to thank him for that, right? Thanks, Brandon Bean, for doing it all in one fell swoop. Catch everybody on the next episode of Tim Graham and Friends, brought to you by CTBK, CPAs and Business Consultants.
The financial needs of a business go beyond tax and attest services. That's why CTBK goes beyond accounting services and offers outsourced solutions through their affiliation with CFO Solutions Plus. These additional services allow clients to focus on their operational and long-term strategic goals. Trust CTBK's outsourced solutions to provide cost-effective, value-added financial services tailored to your company's needs. Call CTBK at 716-630-2400. Again, 716-630-2400. Or go to ctbk.com to learn more about CTBK's outsourced solutions. We'll be right back.